Hey, it's David Weiner, writer and director of In Search of Tomorrow, and you are listening to The Graveyard Show.
Welcome to The Graveyard.
Welcome to another edition of the Graveyard Show podcast. I am your caretaker, and the graveyard is open. Well, as you heard at the top of the show, an old friend of the program has returned. Of course, I'm talking about writer-director of the new film In Search of Tomorrow. David Weiner is back in the graveyard to talk about his latest film, his super documentary, as I like to call it, on 1980s science fiction. So changing it up here on the Graveyard Show podcast, going to talk a little science fiction these next two podcasts with David Weiner. This one we're going to talk about making the film, getting prepared for the movie, and then next podcast he and I will get into the meat of the matter and we will discuss the actual film itself. It is almost 5 hours long. It is epic. It is awesome. And you don't have to be a fan of 80s sci-fi to love this. You don't even have to be a fan of science fiction to love this. If you're a fan of films, you're going to love this movie. And yes, I did see it. And yes, I've already pre-ordered it. And I am so happy to have done so. But before I get to David, I wanted to mention the latest edition of Catacombs of Horror is now available. It is online. You can find it on YouTube, among other places. It is a video production, and actually David was on the very first version of Catacombs of Horror. He joined me, and he and I discussed 1980s horror, and we both selected what we thought best represented 1980s horror. The second edition that came out was my favorite scenes from the 1970 horror film Count Yorga Vampire. And that one is incredibly popular. Happy to see that. Well, this latest edition of Catacombs of Horror is about my favorite scenes and what I thought was a missed opportunity with the film Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers. I also discuss why I think outside of the original Halloween, it is the most important film in the series. Now, when I mean series, I'm talking about from the original Halloween up through Halloween Resurrection. I don't discuss the Rob Zombie remake and sequel, nor do I talk about the latest sequels with Jamie Lee Curtis, Halloween 2018 or Halloween Kills. So this, I think, you're going to find very interesting, and I look forward to seeing you in my Catacombs of Horror. If you'd like to reach out to the program, you could do so at the email address, gyspodcast@gmail.com. That is caretakersawesome@gmail.com. Thoughts, comments, suggestions. If you've seen In Search of Darkness, if you've seen In Search of Tomorrow, let me know what you think about it. I'd love to hear from you as always. And if you are a part of the horror community and you're looking for a little bit of promotion, drop me a line as well. Now, regarding In Search of Tomorrow, if it's something that you want to purchase, they are doing pre-orders right now for a limited time. It's from now through March 27th. And you can find out more information at 80sscifidoc.com. That is 80sscifidoc.com. 80sscifidoc.com. You get all the information on there as well. And on the other side of this interview, I will mention all the different tiers that are available for purchase for In Search of Tomorrow. In the meantime, as you hear in the background, a new grave is being added because an old friend of the show, a really good friend of the show, someone who I look forward to speaking to on this program is here, David Weiner. We're here to talk science fiction, and it's time for me to get to work. Joining me now is a friend of the program and frequent guest. He is the director of In Search of Darkness Parts 1 and 2. And with his latest film, In Search of Tomorrow, he is ready to do for 1980s science fiction films like he's done with 1980s horror films. And you can learn more about In Search of Tomorrow by going to 80sscifidoc.com. Of course, I'm talking about the writer and director of the film, Mr. David Weiner. David, it's great having you back on the show.
Always a pleasure to open the gates loudly when they creak and walk around and check out my favorite gravestones and talk to myself.
Well, that's...
Well, because no one's in the graveyard, right? That's the concept.
Exactly.
Except you. Wait a minute. I don't know if that sounded bad. I don't know.
No, it's very true, because usually I'm the one walking around the graveyard talking to myself.
I'm trying to work with the concept here. It's a pleasure to be back.
And it's appreciated, and it's great having you back. I've missed our conversations. I've seen the film In Search of Tomorrow. It is awesome. I just can't wait to talk to you about this film. So, first off, at what point did producer Robin Block tell you that he wanted to tackle 1980s science fiction films like he did 1980s horror films?
Actually, very early on in the process, when we were just still making the first In Search of Darkness movie. And we would have chats, and behind me I have this giant original one sheet from Star Trek the Motion Picture, this amazing art, I believe it's John Berkey of the Enterprise. And that might have just sort of sunk into his brain, that he's just like, if there's one guy who is probably qualified to direct this movie, it might be David Weiner. You know, so I think I was running a subliminal campaign, because I've always been such a huge sci-fi fan, alongside all sorts of genre film, you know, action and horror and everything in between, cult films. So Robin was already percolating that he could turn this In Search of series, when he started with In Search of the Last Action Heroes and then went to horror, the next logical step, as far as he was concerned, was to do sci-fi. And, you know, ever since my days in this, working for Famous Monsters, I was always proud of being able to put horror and sci-fi and fantasy in that magazine. And so it's a natural progression for me as well.
So that's funny that you have a one sheet of Star Trek the Motion Picture, because there's some great references to that movie in Search of Tomorrow. And I have always found that that's an underrated film. I know that the original version of it was sort of a mess, because it was they were trying to jam it out really quickly for its release date. But I found that the Robert Wise edit that was done, and I think it was like 2000 or 2001, I found that it made the film so much better, so much tighter, even the updated CG that they did. But it's one of my favorite Star Trek films. It might not be, well, it's probably fourth or fifth, maybe, out of the six, which really isn't that high, but...
but there are so many, but, you know, yeah. It still is higher ranked because there's so many.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, as far as science fiction then, how far back do you go as a fan? I mean, do you go back to Metropolis days of the silent science fiction film, or the 40s and 50s sort of your thing?
Yeah. Well, you know, I saw Metropolis when it first came out in the theater in 1927, and I was such a fan of, you know, Georges Méliès, and, you know, Fritz Lang, you know, tried his hand, and okay, so maybe I'm not that old.
I feel old sometimes. I may be that old, but I don't know about you.
I am a 70s kid and an 80s teen. I was born in 68, so there's before Star Wars and there's after Star Wars. So before Star Wars, I was a Trekkie through and through. I was a huge Star Trek fan. Planet of the Apes, giant kaiju monster movies, and Roger Corman B movies, anything like that. But if it had to do with the imagination, I was in Logan's Run, all that kind of stuff. And then of course, like many, many, many of my generation, Star Wars came along and just changed the game. Once Star Wars came along, that really changed the way I approached filmmaking, you know, as from an excited audience to the kind of person who wanted to understand how, you know, who makes these models, who designs these creatures, who's this Ralph McQuarrie guy, you know? Mm-hmm. That's when I started finding Starlog magazine, you know, that's when I started reading about this stuff to really, you know, nourish my soul about what all this stuff was about and who the people were that were making it, not just the stars of the movie.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny that you mentioned that, because this is something that I definitely want to talk to you about as we move on here in this interview, because that was something that stood out to me in the film. And it was something I was glad you brought up in the movie, which, again, we'll talk about that later. But so when you look at prepping for something like this? Now, I know you've already done this once with In Search of Darkness. So when you start prepping for In Search of Tomorrow, where do you start?
It's very hard. You start with a list. You start with a list of all the movies that came out, and you start already subdividing that list. And you have to decide, I think, fundamentally, I'm going to even change my answer. The list starts with determining what's sci-fi and what's not, because sci-fi is such a broad, you know, all-encompassing genre where I had to decide, well, are Mad Max movies sci-fi? You know, is Swamp Thing sci-fi? You know, time travel, that's very much sci-fi, you know. So all these movies that sort of have these elements, you know, they fit. But what about the what-if genre? What about these, you know, war games or something like that? You know, technology that's just around the corner but not necessarily real, yet telling a story that reflects the times. You know, does that qualify? And once I was able to sort of determine that I really did have the elbow room and the freedom to go wider, that's when I really began to enjoy no limitations on covering this decade.
So when you did In Search of Darkness 2, it was during the pandemic. And now here you are again, or here you were again, I should say, getting ready to make In Search of Tomorrow. So was there a concern that the film would suffer because of the pandemic?
Absolutely. It took longer to deliver this because of the pandemic. This is a pandemic film through and through. Because once we were getting interviews for In Search of Darkness Part 2, I was also at the same time starting to get interviews for In Search of Tomorrow. And there was lots of starts and stops, lots of people who had said, yes, they'll do it, but then they couldn't make themselves available. Lots of people who said, yes, they could do it. And then once people started emerging after getting their vaccinations, all of a sudden their work got busy and then they were, you know, couldn't make themselves available. Also, we just wanted to make sure everybody was safe, you know?
Yep.
And we wanted to shoot outdoors. And that sense, you know, presents a whole other set of production, you know, challenges that we ultimately overcame. But part of this film was shot in my backyard.
Wow.
You know, because I needed a controlled environment where I could have people come in, we could set something up, whether it's using either the environment that I've got or what we call the prom stand, you know, the prom background, you know, just to sort of divide it up in terms of the myriad people coming through and the backgrounds. But all I can say is that, listen, if you have the likes of Adrian Barbeau, Sam J. Jones, Flash Gordon, you know, Alex Winter, Bruce Boxleitner, Walter Koenig, you know, Chekhov from Star Trek, you know, Will Smith, you know, coming into your backyard just to chat about movies, boy, you know, pinch me. That's enough. I don't mind this pandemic so much.
Yeah, not a bad gig, right?
Exactly.
So, I mean, at what point? I mean, what was the carousel like there? Oh, little Logan's Run reference there, unintended. But what was the carousel?
I like the carousels that are not the last ride you ever did.
Yeah, exactly. So, what was that like? I mean, would you do like multiple interviews in a day, or would you do like one a day because of the pandemic?
Yeah, production always presents these problems of scheduling. It's like herding cats. And so the most time efficient and money efficient way is to get as many interviews in a day as you can. Mm-hmm. And there are days when we aspire to get two or three interviews or more in a day. But it's catch as catch can, and we're happy to get everyone to agree to sit down for at least an hour or more. And to be able to sit down with some of these people for 2 hours, sometimes 3 hours, you know, and they're happy to be there, happy to talk about the movies they love as well as their own projects, it's fine.
Yeah.
You know? So it was a little bit of everything.
How many interviews would you say you did for this particular film?
Well, we have 70 plus people in this film.
Wow.
And so I did a lot of interviews.
Wow. So when you put the guest list together for the interviews, how much of that is you and how much of that is Robin?
Robin allows me to pretty much have carte blanche. You know, we always go work over this stuff together, you know, to who can best maximize, you know, the storytelling and the star power, you know, in terms of the draw. But at the end of the day, one of the reasons why I love working with Robin so much is that he trusts my instincts and he trusts my creative impulses. And he knows that I'm going to tell the story I need to tell with the people I need to tell it with. And so it's really just a question of, you know, who can I get and how can I get them? And, you know, putting a wide variety of faces and experiences in front of the camera.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it kind of comes down to me, and it's something that I really enjoy. You know, it's such a challenge to get people sometimes.
Sure.
But when they say yes, it's just an absolute high. And then once that, you know, once you wrap that shoot, you're just you're walking on air because you got so much amazing material from some of these people.
Yeah. Now, are you also shooting it yourself, or did you have somebody there that was shooting it for you?
Akte Ortabasi is our director of photography. He sets up and he does the sound and he shoots it, and he's great. And he has a soundstage in Los Angeles that we use. And but when we can't be in the soundstage because we don't want COVID air to fog up the place, he would come to my backyard or we'd go to people's houses. You know, whatever was most convenient for all these folks.
Yeah. You don't have to give any names. This is just more of a general question, but was there anyone that you really, really wanted to get for this film and you couldn't?
Always with all of my projects. Yeah. My wish list is much bigger than who we ultimately get. And the thing is, when I say who we ultimately get, I have to cap the list at a certain point. You know, you could just go on and on and on. Listen, as you well know, I delivered a 5-hour film. And In Search of Darkness movies are 4.5 hours each. And the thing is, the more people you get, the more you can talk about. Also, the more people you get, the less screen time everybody gets. And
yeah.
So there's a certain alchemy of putting these things together where everyone is there to tell their tale, but you want to spread them around to be able to participate in this collaborative story of a decade and a genre. So, you know, once we pass the 50 interviews mark.
Yeah.
Then we really, you know, I was ambitious to head to 70 to 75 on this one. But I think any more would be too many.
And what I like is that it works because you kind of go, and I don't remember if you did this for In Search of Darkness. I don't think you really, well, you kind of did, but you had film critics in this one. You had a little bit more of variety outside of the traditional director star.
Yes.
Which is really good. How much of that was planned, or was that something that just kind of happened? You go, oh, I'd like to get this person. Oh, wait, that's a psychologist, or this is a teacher,
Yeah, exactly. This was planned a little more in advance because due to the nature of the material with sci-fi, there's a lot of sort of reality-based conversation to be had, especially with the technology. And the advances of technology that we use every day that are inspired by the movies that came out. And so I thought having Gray Scott, who's a futurist, I thought would be a great voice to sort of lend some context to some of these films and the conversation. A clinical psychologist, I think, is very interesting when you're talking about character studies, you know, and storytelling. Hey, there's an astrophysicist who is a movie geek and filmmaker himself, Stephen DeGeneres. I can never say his name. Sorry, Stephen. Stephen DeGeneres. I think it really rounds out the conversation. You know, Tim Cardshell, who's an NPR film critic. It's important to sort of dissect this in a variety of different ways to tell a very large story.
You know who I thought was a really sort of good anchor for this was Will Wheaton.
Mm-hmm.
I found that he's a good intro into it, and obviously having been a part of Next Generation, he's also a big fan of sci-fi. And I thought he really brought a lot to it, and I thought he was a good sort of like good reset every time he would come in.
He's an absolute treat, you know, a treat to have in our film. We're very grateful that he would, you know, I kind of knew that because he's like a pop culture geek and nerd as well, and well known for that in addition to his acting work and chops. And I just sort of knew that people would connect with his take on things. And just so pleased to have him come over and talk about all sorts of things. And I agree completely. You know, it's just, it's real nice to have his, you know, he also sort of straddles, I think, some a certain generation that really loved these movies on a slightly younger side of it. And so I think that's a great sort of bridge for the Gen X folks and the people, you know, who came after.
Now, I'm assuming most, if not all, of the crew that you worked with on In Search of Darkness joined you on this journey for In Search of Tomorrow. Did that make it easier assembling this film from beginning to end?
Absolutely, yeah. We have this wonderful team at Creator VC. We're a small team. We're pretty much about 10 people, and we're dotted around the globe in the UK, you know, Berlin, you know, Texas, you know, all over the map. And so we all work very, very efficiently together. We're all responsible and reliable for the things that we need to get done. We use the time zone difference to our advantage. Robin has assembled like a dream team, and we all love working with each other, and we get to work on the stuff that we love, the movies we love, the concepts we love, the genres we love, and work doesn't seem like work so much anymore. And we all have established a track record of really being able to develop these films, produce these films, market these films, distribute these films all ourselves, and beholden to no one but ourselves and to Robin and his vision. And it's real nice because we have ultimate creative control on these projects. And that's what keeps us going.
Yeah, I can tell because, I mean, having had you on, obviously, several times on this show, I had Robin on not too long ago, Weary Pines, Jamie and Don. And there's a theme through all these interviews where you can tell everybody enjoys working with everybody, and there's a great creative flow between all of you that really makes this work.
I the fact that you brought up Weary Pines, Jamie and Don, I want to give a special shout out to them. They really, really assembled an amazing score for this film, and I really enjoyed working with them on In Search of Darkness 1 and 2. And so with In Search of Tomorrow, we were going for a different feel, yet still a bit of the synth wave that people have been responding to with these films. And so I think I pushed them a little bit out of I wouldn't say out of their comfort zone, but out of what they're used to doing. But we moved this from, you know, a horror score to a very, very much, you know, everything from Jean-Michel Jarre to Giorgio Moroder inspired score that I think really is I'm very proud of, you know, for In Search of Tomorrow.
And I picked that up right at the top when you had that montage from the different decades, and you could hear the change in the tonality of the cue as it was going and sort of playing along with the image that was on screen, which I thought was really, really a nice touch to start off. Having done now two In Search of Darkness films before going into In Search of Tomorrow, was there anything that you learned from doing those two In Search of Darkness films that you applied, whether it was a good thing or something that you had learned that maybe a mistake or something that you should have looked into when making In Search of Tomorrow?
I would think the biggest transition in terms of my mindset and my approach to all this is the script writing process. Because I realized that horror versus sci-fi, when you're trying to explain a lot of these films, there's a little more groundwork that's required, a little more structuring that's required to be able to tell these stories about these individual films and explain what the film's about, talk a little bit about the theme, throw in some behind-the-scenes nuggets and information, and general appreciation or dissection of these films. It takes a little longer. And so you find you being me, I found that I was delivering like a 6.5-hour rough cut, and I knew that that was too long. But the problem was everything just seemed perfectly right, and it was sort of a crime to cut these things down. But it was required, and that's a process that I have to do with every film I do. But something about sci-fi is a little different. It's a little more intellectual versus a visceral, emotional reaction you have to a lot of horror films. And while there's plenty of emotion in response to a lot of these films, there's a little more of brain work involved in terms of the structure of each movie segment. And so that was something that I kind of had to pivot and adjust to in terms of my approach.
Sure. I mean, you could have done this film just on time travel movies and just everything that comes with that. So yeah, mm-hmm. I can't even imagine. Like, the fact that you said that you only came in at a rough cut of 6.5 hours, I'm kind of surprised. I thought it might have been like 8 because,
well,
you know.
It could have been 8, but I think Samuel Way, my editor, would have killed me. And I think Robin would have fired me. I would have had to do it all on my own with crayons and scotch tape, but I still would have done it.
I believe you when you say that, too. Not that you would have gotten fired, but I can see you sitting there with crayons going, damn it, I'm going to finish this damn movie.
Right. I've storyboarded the next 38 hours, but no one's going to see it.
Exactly. What I love about your movies is that each one has its own identity. The In Search of Darkness films, 1 and 2, they differed in tone. They had slight change in graphics presentation. And with this one, it certainly stands out separate from them. How much of a conscious effort was there made to make sure that this was a very different style or a different look than the other In Search of Darkness films?
Well, it's sort of hand in hand with the marketing of it as well. You know, the poster art, you've got amazing poster art by Dave Morrell of that, of the astronaut with the 80s heroes and villains facing off of each other. That is just so inspirational. We have an original poster from Clayton Benge, our in-house art director, who's amazing. Graham Humphreys did sort of a more horror sci-fi based one as well. That's all the marketing stuff. So when it comes to the film itself, because marketing is done ahead of the production of the film or during the production of the film, it kind of helps inform the look of the film as well. But we made a key, you know, Robin and I sat down and we said, what's this film going to be? How is it going to be different? Yet people who love our other films, In Search of Darkness, In Search of Darkness Part 1 or 2, and Last Action Heroes, you know, how is this going to be in the same vein or different? And we came to the conclusion that, you know, he really loves the structure of going through a decade, you know, film by film, and larger context chapters and topics in between. And if it ain't broke, don't fix it, you know? And so that really kind of helped us steer through another massive decade with the confidence that if people like those movies, they'll like this one, because this is taking the same, you know, the structure that they responded so well to.
Now, there was a decision made to do a final pre-order campaign for In Search of Tomorrow, and it's going to run from now through March 27th. When did that decision get made, and how long did it take to kind of make that decision?
Well, this is similar to how we've done the previous two films. You know, we crowdfunded first, and then what we do is when the film is finally ready, we can't do a sales campaign where you just sell it, because you know, we manufacture these to order, and you can't anticipate what the number is going to be. Plus, we love being able to put everyone who is a backer to feel important and feel like they're supporting this project and feel like they're part of this whole effort and this journey, and so they get their name in the credits. And so it ends up being an order campaign or a pre-order campaign. We're just calling, you know, it's basically just order your copy in this window until March 27th. And then we'll put your name in the credits, and then we'll get the film manufactured and out to everybody.
And what I love is
wonderful package of, you know, posters and stickers and digital copy and all sorts of cool stuff that you can find on 80sscifidoc.com.
There you go. And for everybody listening, I'll get into the perks on the other side when David and I are done here. What I love is that you also you allow people to jump back on the train, which is really nice. And you've also did something really cool for those that already bought that jumped on the producer level backers. Mm-hmm. Back on February 19th here in Los Angeles. You guys had a big premiere for In Search of Tomorrow. So what was it like screening that in front of an audience?
It's the greatest thing that you could do for a film when you've been living in a vacuum and the only people that you're bouncing this off of are a very small handful of the people that you work with. And so it's wonderful to have the confidence, you know, that you're doing what you do, and you being me. I always, you know, throw around all different first person, second person, third person, and, you know, I confuse myself in the process. But the premiere was for the producer level backers. We get to meet the faces of the people who are so enthusiastically supporting these projects. And there are people who came, you know, from across the Atlantic, you know, to come here to Los Angeles to the Hollywood premiere. It was just wonderful to be able to sit there. We divided it, because it's a five-hour film, into a two-and-a-half-hour start, you know, 1980 to 1984, and then a chapter, and then a break. And then we had a Q&A, and it was myself, it was Robin, it was Lance Guest from The Last Starfighter, and Tim Cogshell of NPR, Angelique Roche, who is also, she's the host of Sci-Fi Wire and she's a pop culture journalist, she moderated the Q&A. It was just really wonderful to have that, and then to finish the rest of the film. But to be able to sit there and listen to people gasp and laugh and cry and emote and just enjoy and be entertained for something that they've been waiting for and helped support and bring to life is just such a rewarding experience. And you know, you don't get that very often as a filmmaker, and these days, with, you know, having a premiere in the middle of, you know, we're still in a pandemic, believe it or not, it was my first time in a theater in 2 years. So that was quite the experience for me. And it was just great to be able to do that.
You know, I want to get into the film, but let's hold that for the next podcast. So here's what we'll do. I'm going to go and tell everybody all the perks they can get when they pre-order In Search of Tomorrow. And you and I will pick up this conversation next show. So in the meantime, while I tell them what they can get, why don't you just hang here in the graveyard and just keep talking to yourself, and we'll pick this conversation up next week.
I will sit here and twiddle my thumbs and look at the stars, listen to the crickets, and try not to get too cold from the wind.
Very good. I will be right back. And as I put this interview on pause, there goes David right now. You see, he's just, you know, there he is on the other side of the graveyard. He's already found something that's caught his interest. You know what I love about David? David and I are very similar this way. He and I can just find ways to just kind of pass the time, and, you know, I'm not worried that he's just going to be hanging out until the next podcast. Knowing him, he'll probably take and rearrange the graveyard and make it even better than what it is, knowing him. All right. So while David just patiently waits for us to return here for the next show, I want to more importantly get to, two things. One, independent horror. When I started the Graveyard Show podcast back in 2009, I was very proud to say that the Graveyard Show podcast was a huge proponent for independent horror, because independent horror for me is something that is not only important, I feel that it's the backbone of the genre. And I can say the same thing for independent science fiction as well. Independent documentaries. I mean, you can really put it across all genres, right? So independent filmmakers are really, really important. I mean, a lot of very popular and mainstream filmmakers started off as independent filmmakers, and they became popular, and they had an amazing career, and some of them still have amazing careers that came from the independent circuit. So what I'm getting at is, you know, David and Robin and Sam and everybody else that works on these In Search of Darkness films or Tomorrow and anything else that may be coming up here, you know, they're putting their heart and soul into these films. If you have not seen these movies yet, okay, first of all, you can go find In Search of Darkness 1 and 2 on Shudder. So those of you that have Shudder, it's there. I just checked just to make sure it's still streaming. They are there. you should go see them. Again, you don't have to be fans of just 80s horror to enjoy that or enjoy this latest film for science fiction. Okay, these are great documentaries. They're well done, well researched, well put together across the board. This is A-plus work that these filmmakers do. Okay, so if you can support these guys as best you can, if you're able to afford these movies, please go out and do so. It just means the world to them. First of all, the love that you guys send them and the high praise you give them is one thing. They love that. Another thing is to, because it's a business, if you can financially support these guys, that is awesome. I put my money where my mouth is. When In Search of Darkness Part 2 was available for pre-order, I did it. When In Search of Tomorrow was available for pre-order, I did that. The only reason why I didn't do it with the first one was because I learned about In Search of Darkness past the point of purchase. But I do have a copy of it with In Search of Darkness 2. But I've told both David and Robin that I am going to buy a hard copy of In Search of Darkness. That's how much I love that movie. And I think having them on a bookshelf, going old school here, folks, having them on a bookshelf says a lot. I think it's just something that you can just take out and you can drop in your DVD player and off you go, your Blu-ray player, and you can watch them. You have literally, between these three movies, you have about 13 to 14 hours worth of amazing information. Right now, Creator VC, for a very limited time, are offering In Search of Tomorrow, the definitive 80s sci-fi documentary. They are offering that now for pre-order from now until March 27th. So very quickly, I'm going to go over the perks. These are all in US dollars. The standard Blu-ray perk for $69.99 US dollars. It is Blu-ray copy of In Search of Tomorrow, the slipcase, digital copy of In Search of Tomorrow. You're going to get your name in the credits. You're going to get three posters by Dave Morrell. Okay, these things are beautiful. And if you haven't seen them, you got to go on the website to take a look at them. They're fantastic. You'll also get a digital copy of the In Search of Tomorrow soundtrack by New Retro Wave, as well as some In Search of Tomorrow stickers. For the standard DVD perk, for $74.99, you get everything. Instead of the Blu-ray, it'll be the DVD. So the In Search of Tomorrow DVD, slipcase, digital copy, three posters, name in the credits, digital soundtrack by New Retro Wave, and then the In Search of Tomorrow stickers. The associate producer perk for $1,400 US dollars, you will get all the other stuff that I just previously mentioned. Blu-ray, not DVD. You'll get the Blu-ray instead of the DVD. You will also get the associate producer credit on IMDb, poster, and in the movie credits, in addition to obviously the Blu-ray. The producer perk for $2,800 US dollars. Again, you get all the other stuff, posters, Blu-ray, digital copies, and then you will get a producer credit on IMDb, poster, and in the movie credits, in addition to, obviously, all the other stuff. And then, last but not least, the executive producer perk for $5,600 US dollars. You get the Blu-ray, you get the digital copies, you get the posters, the stickers, and the executive producer credit on IMDb, poster, and in the movie credits as well. So if you are able to purchase any of those perks, please do so. I know David and Robin and everybody else there at Creator VC would appreciate it. And like I said, I've purchased two of these already. So In Search of Darkness Part 2 and this. And they're awesome. They are fantastic. So when we reconvene here in the graveyard, David and I will discuss the film. Not in great detail because, well, we want you to enjoy it without having any spoilers. So, but there's a lot to talk about. So, without giving away any surprises in the film. So, come on back and we will discuss more about In Search of Tomorrow. And again, 80sscifidoc.com is the website that you can go to learn more about this film. Graveyard Show Podcast is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and, well, everywhere podcasts exist. There is, of course, the YouTube channel, And as I mentioned before, Catacombs of Horror can be found right there as well. You know, if you are a podcast subscriber, thank you, of course, very much. If you get a chance to rate the show on wherever you listen to it, I would greatly appreciate that. And I just wanted to throw out there as well that you may want to subscribe to the Graveyard Show Podcast's YouTube channel, because there is a lot of stuff that I am working on, and there's going to be stuff going up that may get there before the next podcast land where I can tell you about them. So if you want to check out the latest Catacombs of Horror, or if you want to find out about anything new, you may want to subscribe to the Graveyard Show Podcast on YouTube. So when things come up, you can get there as soon as they're available online. In the meantime, if you know anyone who is a fan of horror or sci-fi, please send them over to the Graveyard Show Podcast. New friends and listeners are always welcome. And as you exit the graveyard, I would like to remind you to please lock the gate behind you. We wouldn't want anyone to get out. Until next time.